Welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program,
and brought to you through the Toorak Times.
This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
Greetings and welcome to the third and final part of the story of the life and times of Robert Lloyd. A baby boomer, Robert was born to creative and artistic parents in Adelaide in 1948. Immersing himself in music, Robert packs up his drums and travels to Melbourne in the early 60s, where he establishes himself as a top drummer, playing in some of Australia's most popular bands of that period. Eventually finding the job of simply keeping the beat to be very limiting, if not straight out boring, Robert travels widely studying music, poetry, writing from various countries and various eras. He develops a love of polyrhythm and sharpens his writing and compositional skills. We learn more about this music development and begin to understand what drives this man, who, like many of his generation, see the move into the third age of life as not the end, but the opportunity for continued growth. This is a fascinating conclusion to a great story of a member of a generation, the baby boomers, that have contributed so much to our culture and continue to do so. We share some of his poetry and his music. But now, here's Robert talking about his musical growth.
I started to think about all those drummers that had their own bands, like Art Blakey and then Tony Williams and other people. So more and more I became, oh, I can be a drummer who runs his own band. So I started to see myself as this composer and started writing little melodies and tunes. And then eventually I stopped all that and I went to the Sydney Conservatorium and got in studying piano, music theory and percussion. So I studied orchestral percussion. So my mind shifted into this space of why don't I start looking at all kinds of things. Because I could see that jazz musicians had been studying orchestral music, like, you know, Gil Evans and Gunther Schuller and modern jazz quartet. There was this, you know, kind of flirting with contemporary classical music became a thing. And particularly moving to Sydney, my whole headspace sort of changed, and I didn't feel I was just kind of locked into some, you know, rock, jazz, blues thing. So I don't think I was ever really, really involved in really commercial music. I was interested in the poetry of Allen Ginsberg, because anyone interested in Bob Dylan would have heard about Allen Ginsberg. So Howl by Allen Ginsberg, Kerouac, that kind of the Beat Generation poets. So that all that stuff fascinated me. People who stood up and read their material against, say, a jazz group. So all that opened up, and I got very interested in vibraphone. And then the other thing I got interested in was Balinese gamelan music. So I lived in Bali for 6 months. I lived in a village called Ubud.
Did you just go there cold? Or?
No. I actually had a... I think what happened is I had a dream one night of this demon with long, long fingernails. And I thought, did I dream that or did I see that in a movie or a book somewhere? And I'm not quite sure. Maybe it was an old black and white movie of this character called Baris or Barong. It was a character, a masked demonic sort of character that dances in Balinese theatre. And accompanying that fantastic live theatre with masks was this orchestra called the gamelan. So I got totally fascinated by gamelan music, because basically it was like maybe 43 rice farmers who were all playing percussion instruments, creating this incredible driving but very tight, intricate music. And so that was a total fascination. I was absolutely absorbed.
So you had this dream and you just packed up and went?
When I was living in Sydney, the Piliatan gamelan, who were the best gamelan on the island, actually came to Australia. I saw them at the Science Block Theatre in Sydney, and they were just amazing. It wasn't like one, two, three, four, and away they go. It would be like 35 guys just completely still, and all of a sudden, this incredible. And I thought, how did they do that? How do they just all know to go make that explosion together? And eventually, when I studied the music in Bali, I think he raised that eyebrow, and then they were away. And I thought, these guys are way more advanced than jazz musicians, way more advanced than classical musicians. There's the simpatico that these musicians, who were essentially rice farmers, had together was just unbelievable. And I thought, so I became fascinated with, you know, all things Asian then, like Balinese music. And then, of course, it then transferred onto an interest in Zen Buddhism and Japanese culture, and then Hindu culture and Indian rags. And so I was totally absorbed, like many of us from that generation, in Asian culture and how magic that was and how other that was. And only things, only jazz and beat poetry was only hinting at that. So I had to sort of like immerse myself in that. I had to jump right into the deep end of the
swimming pool. So you did that by going there?
We did that by going there. I got was able to get a 6-month visa via the Indonesian embassy in Canberra. So I stayed, unlike other people, they couldn't stay that long. I had this 6-month visa and lived in this village called Ubud. And also Piliatown, which is just sort of down the road from it. So I could show this to the local people, this thing from the Indonesian government, and that sort of gave me some kind of entree to learn the instruments. And I also learned a little bit of dance while I was there too. I learned this dance called the Jalk. So all that connection between theatre, voice, music, dance became this huge sort of thing for me. Mm-hmm. So that just opened my mind up to all kinds of other, you know, possibilities then. So I kind of left all that idea of being a drummer behind, really, in Melbourne. And even though I played drums in rock bands for a while, when the disco craze hit, of course, it was in the 70s, that was the end of the line for me. I thought, if a drummer can be replaced by a machine, the drumming is not worth being drumming. It's I don't know what it is. It's robot. It's just not interesting. There's not enough humanity in it. And, of course, everyone kind of got addicted to this kind of robot, you know, music. And
was that a negative period for you emotionally?
I found it to be quite negative because it really hit me. Having had all those experiences, I moved to Adelaide, which is where I come from, and I really wanted to explore different musical kind of ideas there, and also I actually wanted to get away from Sydney and that whole kind of culture for a while. But it was almost like everything was, you know, kind of not in a place where I felt connected to music. And it's not uncommon. I went through a period where I hardly played because I just didn't find music interesting at all. Because music then became about just going to discos and, you know, dancing to the kind of music, which is like Donna Summer's Hot Stuff and all that. I mean, I think that's fine, you know, to kind of dance to, but as a player...
Not for a working musician.
No.
Not for an intelligent working musician.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I saw it was like quarter of what's going on in music to me. It's all about, you know, shaking your booty, which is terrific. I mean, I like to get up and dance too. So I felt like in the music industry, a lot of the music and a lot of the energy moved to other places because what was happening, film was becoming really interesting. There was performance art was coming in, all kinds of amazing things. So yes. I became interested in everything. And out of that grew also, you know, words. You know, I was writing poetry and I had been writing poetry for years. And then that poetry started to turn into... working with terrific writers, so I'd be working on theatre pieces where I'd write music for theatre pieces. I'd collaborate on acting in some of those theatre pieces, but I'd have a small acting role, and there'd be maybe live music in the thing. So I was later on, we're talking 80s now, I was working with Open City Theatre Company in Sydney, On Track Theatre Company. Really, really interesting experimental, for want of a better word, theatre companies. So all those things, you know, working with words, acting, and so on, started to kind of create a whole new way of making a living for me.
Do you have any poetry from that period?
I probably do.
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices. Turning Back Time. Turning Back Time. Turning Back Time. Turning Back Time.
I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Robert Lloyd, poet, songwriter, composer.
This one mentions Pellegrini's in Melbourne, so it might be a good one to use. Poem Friend. These poems have kept me alive since 1966. Even the ones not written have words enough to get me through lonely winter nights in Melbourne. As close as a cup of coffee at Pellegrini's with an old friend, these poems stroll with me through my life, commenting, questioning, showing me what I don't see. What are friends for if not to do this? All my songs are poems trying to keep me honest.
Now, that comes from a book that you released this year called Black Guitar, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
How did the concept for a book come about?
I think any creative work, but certainly this book, it really grew out of the fact that I had lots of songs that I'd written, lots of poems, and a certain amount of prose. And it's just oozing. It's just dying to get out. It's. I'm a real believer that in the whole creative process is you create something, you make something, you put it out there, to a public, and you get feedback, and it's just loop. You put it out, you get applause or whatever, or some comment, and that's what keeps the cycle moving. So I've always got to keep producing something.
I'd like to come back to Black Guitar before we finish the interview and ask you for another poem. But in talking about producing work, and as you said, work that you probably originally wrote for music, when did you actually release your own first musical piece?
I think it was about 1973.
That early?
That early. And I think it grew out of a big fascination. We were talking earlier about Barney's gamelan music, and I became fascinated with the sounds of repeating patterns. And what it was this sort of absolutely, Zen moment. I remember I was had a tape recorder, an old Sony tape recorder at the time, and I was doodling away with this da 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 kind of pattern. 1 and 2 and 3 and 1 and 2 and 3. And then across it, just a couple of days later, I started playing this other line, which is da 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 da. This whole other pattern, which was in 4. And I thought, oh, this is not gonna work. 1's in 3, 1's in 4. But what happened is just this beautiful thing of the 4s across the 3s made this incredible thing of like 3 4s of 12, 4 3s of 12. So every 12th beat, it would meet and then go out of sync again. And I thought, my God, I've sort of invented some new concept here. And so I played with this idea more and more and more. So Bhakti was the first piece that did that. Sort of created not Barney's gamelan music, so I wasn't interested in recreating that, but I got this unique kind of sound world with 2 vibraphones, glockenspiel, and small bells. So Bhakti was the beginning of that, and I released that on an album called Starting From Zero.
What is so special or so different in regard to Between Train Stations?
Between Train Stations was, again, one of these sort of magic moments. It actually... The song came about because I had a friend in Melbourne called Christine Macquarie, who used to come to all these gigs that we played at. 20 years later, I was in London, I think it was in maybe 84. I was on a train going back to Paddington where we lived. Between Earls Court and Paddington, I saw her on the train and I thought, wow. So we tried to fill each other in on what we'd done for 20 years between those 2 train stations. And so years later, there I am playing the piano and doodling around with ideas. And so this idea of, sometimes at night, sometimes through the day, I think of you and wonder where you are. And the very last line is, maybe one day I'll see you again between train stations in London. And that became the title of it. It took me 6 months to write this piece because it was a whole new thing for me. Because I had this whole thing about my voice where I thought, maybe I'm not a singer. I've worked with so many good singers. And then I started to think, well, hang on. My father was a great singer. Why can't I be a great singer? I mean, surely it's in the genes. Mm. How I actually got the confidence to sing, I was in synagogue one day on the High Holy Days, and this woman behind me, because I was singing one of the Psalms, and this woman said to me, she said, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but you have a beautiful voice. And I thought, lady, you do not know how important what you've just said to me as a person out of nowhere, how much that means to me.
Affirmation from a stranger means a lot, doesn't it?
It does. It was just brilliant. And I thought, right, that's it. And then I put out my own first CD of songs, Songs of Robert Lloyd, which I did in about 2009, which was the first album with my voice on it, singing songs. Musically, there was definitely connections between the piano parts and the guitar parts to things I'd written before for orchestras and string quartets and so on. But this time with voice. And I think it's a tremendous affirmation of who you are, because I did 10 years ago, I did a whole lot of therapy as well. And that was about finding who you are, really getting a sense of, you know, maybe what you're meant to be. I actually believe the work I'm doing now as a poet and writer is actually what I'm meant to be doing, or as you could say, what God put me on the planet to do. I'm actually probably the happiest and the most content as an artist now than I've ever been in my life.
I would like to explore that as the final part of our interview, but I suspect there's another section of your life that you only just touched upon, and I'd like to go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you were in Britain.
Mm.
Have you done much travelling, and is travelling important to you?
Travelling's really important to me because I think it's something to do with the idea that certain cultures, certain languages, certain sounds resonate with you a lot more strongly than others do. For instance, I remember one of the first things was French culture. You know, I'd always been fascinated with, you know, French films. And I grew up, as probably you did, in the 60s, you know, looking at Jean Le Goddard movies, Truffaut movies, almost like all things French was, you know, that was very cool.
I remember when I first met you, you smoked jetons.
I did. I've got a poem in the book called Cigarettes that actually talks about that, and Jean-Paul Belmondo and so on. So that was, I just had to go to Paris. I knew I just had to go to Paris. And other things attracted me, as we talked about earlier, like Balinese music, that incredible sound of a culture where the idea, and you get this a lot in certain Asian cultures, that music isn't separated from life. It isn't just an entertainment. Mm. It's part of religion. Mm. It's part of the whole celebration of life, and theatre and puppetry and mask making and sculpture. All those things are really part of it. So Bali was important. And the other big city, of course, was New York City. Like all the people, you know, that I, you know, admire so much, like, you know, the Velvet Underground and, you know, kind of Bob Dylan and all the great writers, and even Dylan Thomas, you know, probably one of my favourite poets, had died at the Chelsea Hotel in New York City. So, of course, I had to go, you know, to...
Almost do a pilgrimage. Almost.
I had to do a pilgrimage, yeah. You know, to New York City. And it was amazing, you know, because I had sent some tapes on ahead, and I ended up doing some programs with John Schaefer from WNYC in New York, which they still play. So my... a lot of the instrumental pieces that I wrote for dance companies in America with Melissa Fenley, who I work with a lot in New York at the Joyce Theatre, which is in Chelsea. So there was that opened a whole big door for me working in New York, and my whole entree into New York came through working with Melissa Fenley, the choreographer, and then through WNYC with John Schaefer. And I worked with Philip Glass at the Adelaide Festival, so he was another composer who was an inspiration in it. Support person in New York. So that really, you know, a lot of those things changed. I've also travelled to lots of other places as well. I lived in London for a while. Wasn't so interesting for me. I kind of had a richer experiences in Paris. But I'm attracted certainly by things like, you know, English music, and hopefully I'm going to go to Wales, you know, this year, to the old ancestral homelands, you know, Llangollen and... You know, you want to go to Tintern Abbey, and you want to go to Anglesey, and then also want to go to Cornwall as well, because my family name is Tregilgus, which is a, you know, very, very Cornish name.
Start to tie all this up. I began the interview by asking you whether you saw yourself as a baby boomer. And the baby boomers have been judged, rightly or wrongly, for many good things and maybe many crazy things. But it seems to me one of the things that we as baby boomers are now doing is redefining this latter period of life. We are now moving into that period that we saw our parents as the oldies.
Mm.
And I think it'd be right to say that when we were young, we looked at, and it was probably true, once you hit 60, you retired and you basically crawled into a corner and you'd finished doing things and you sat back and you just reflected.
Mm.
That's not true for you, is it?
Not at all. not at all. I'm totally not connected to that way of thinking at all.
What, very productive and very important part of your life coming out now, isn't it?
There's a line, and I have to quote it, by Leonard Cohen. On his last tour, one of the things he said pretty much every night, and certainly when he was in London, he said, "Ah, I remember London. The last time I was here was 16 years ago. 16 years ago, just a kid with a crazy dream." And it's a beautiful line.
It is.
And I actually see myself in that same light since I've turned 60. I'm really just seeing myself as a kid with a crazy dream. The dream was to, you know, make a living writing, speaking, talking, doing interviews, writing music, playing guitar, playing piano, acting in films, speaking poetry, having a rich and wonderful connection with all people, including you right now with this interview. And to me, that's what makes life important, to be completely alive in the moment. I did a gig at the Goethe Institute in Sydney once, wonderful concert, and I wanted to connect it up to Wolfgang Goethe, you know, the poet himself. Did some research on him, and I found there's this line, Goethe said, "Every day you must see a good painting, read a good poem, sing a good little song." And there was one other one, I can't think what the other one was, maybe see a beautiful girl or a nice sunset. And I thought, well, I try and live like that, yes. That every day you do those things and you create something fresh every day. And if I'm not doing that every day, I start to feel stale. So I don't have a big interest in the past, in nostalgia, only in the sense that it connects to what I'm doing now. You know, I can talk about something like Bhakti and see that piece of music having some connection to some guitar part or piano part that I might be doing now. To me, it's just a long river of flowing from what was upstream, you know, to what's, you know, where I'm at now.
And where are you at now? What are you working on at this very moment?
At this very moment, I'm working on a documentary film with Zev Howley, who's a Melbourne filmmaker, who was recommended to me by another terrific Melbourne filmmaker, Frank Housen, and we're also going to work on another piece together as well. So what's interesting to me is to tie a lot of these things together, because I tried for a long time to just like forget about my past and think, okay, well, what I'm doing now is I'm singing songs with guitar and I won't worry about what I used to do before, even though all of that instrumental music's been published and it's available through the Australian Music Centre, that and people can get access to it. My attitude now is it's all important, it's all useful, and one of the ways to help pull that all together is like interviews like this. I'm talking about all periods of my life. Someone once said, every 7 years, you know, you change what you do. Someone once said Miles Davis, every time he got a new girlfriend, he completely changed his style of music, which could be true. But for me, it's currently I'm doing probably three things. I'm promoting the Black Guitar book. Mm-hmm. So I'm working in bookshops. I'm doing concerts, selling the book, promoting the Songs of Robert Lloyd CD. And I'm really interested and present in making film and working on this, you know, new documentary. And we're sort of searching for a title at present for this, you know, documentary on my life and work.
Well, maybe we could come back sometime in the future and find out how that documentary went.
Well, that would be fine with me, Rob, and thank you very much for this.
And thank you, Robert. And can I ask you, as a way of going out from this wonderful interview, if you could read a poem for us?
I can. This is a piece called Between Train Stations. Sometimes at night, sometimes through the day, I think of you and wonder how you are. Years have passed since you went your way. Did you live in Paris and read Rambo in a cafe? Did you grow to be a star, finding that all you need, and lose your hold and your empathy? You read so much, did it make you wise? Did it fuel your fire? Did it hurt your eyes? I tried to read you most of the time. I must have lost pages along the way. When you wrote, I heard your voice. The story had no end. I remember the sounds you used to make. Old habits do die hard. I failed the task you never put me through. We must have changed so much. You read so much. Did it make you wise? Did it fuel your fire? Did it hurt your eyes? I tried to read you most of the time. I must have lost pages along the way. You read so much. Did it make you wise? Did it fuel your fire? Did it hurt your eyes? Maybe one day I'll see you again between train stations in London.
Sometimes through the day, I think of you. I wonder how you are. Years have passed since you went your way. Did you live in Paris? Read Rambo in a cafe? Did you grow to be a star, finding that all you need? And lose your hold and your empathy? You read so much. Did it make you wise? Did it fuel your fire? Did it hurt your eyes? I tried to read you most of the time. Must have lost pages along the way. Tried to read you most of the time. I must have lost pages along the way. You read so much, did it make you wise? Did it fuel your fire? Did it hurt your eyes? Maybe one day I will see you again between train stations in London.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Turek Times.